This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you. Are the genitals disgusting? One of the last people from whom we might expect an affirmative answer to that question is, or should be, Freud. After all, in the teleological perspective on sexual development, which is the dominant, if not, as I have argued in the Freudian body, the most significant narrative of three essays on the theory of sexuality, genital sexuality, more precisely genital heterosexuality, is the gloriously normative endpoint of the stages of infantile sexuality. However, even in what we might call the three essays' official version of the normal movement of sexual pleasure from the mouth to the anus and finally to the genitals, the latter are an endpoint in more ways than one. If genital heterosexuality is the hierarchical stabilization of sexuality's component drives, and if the pleasure of genital orgasm is, as Freud writes, the highest in intensity, it is nonetheless true that unlike the bodily pleasures that precede it, genital pleasure, Freud writes, is brought about entirely by discharge. Discharge eliminates the tension of the libido, and Freud insists, I quote, "In spite of all the differences of opinion that reign on the subject among psychologists, a feeling of tension necessarily involves unpleasure." While Freud concedes that there is some satisfaction in the tension itself of what he calls the preparatory changes in the genitals, genital pleasure essentially consists in getting rid of genital excitement. Others have noted the peculiarity of this hydraulic model of sexual pleasure. What precedes the orgasm sounds less like sexual excitement and more like an itch or an urge to sneeze or urinate. If there is pre-orgasmic pleasure, it seems to be identical to a kind of pain. There is something dysfunctional in this equivalence between our highest bodily pleasure and unpleasure, or, as I too briefly suggested in the Freudian body, the dysfunctionality should perhaps be located in the relation of our language to our body. Psychoanalysis is unprecedented in the way it attempts to talk about the body. Its failures or its moments of incoherence testify to that alienation from the body which may coincide with our entry into language. Psychoanalysis insists on speaking what cannot be spoken, on theorizing an inherently untheorizable bodily psyche. It seeks to create a type of speakability and of readability at odds with how we have been taught to speak and to read. In doing so, it would provide an account of that which is anterior to all speakable and readable accounting for. Freud's insistence on speaking the body is all the more heroic when we consider that not only is the unpleasurable pleasure of genital excitement a kind of pain, a basis for my arguing after La Planche that in Freud sexuality is a tautology for masochism, at least in its origins, but also that Freud finds the source of this supremely intense pleasure pain somewhat repellent. If, Freud notes in Civilization and Its Discontents, beauty is an object, is an attribute of the objects we sexually desire, I quote, "the genitals themselves, the sight of which is always exciting, are nevertheless hardly ever judged to be beautiful," end quote. The aesthetic status of the bodies we desire is deeply paradoxical. We attribute beauty to the desired body, but the bodily part we always find exciting lacks the very attribute that originally triggered our desire. Attractiveness, real or projected, is not, apparently, a precondition of desirability. Things become more troubling, if less paradoxical, when we descend into what I have called civilization and its discontents textual unconscious, its footnotes. Having argued that the pressure of a sexually repressive civilization prevents us from fully enjoying sex, Freud unexpectedly speculates at the end of chapter 4 that there may be, as he puts it, something in the nature of the sexual function itself which denies us full satisfaction. Freud is reticent about this. The chapter ends with what we might take to be the unacceptable cop-out of, I quote, "This may be wrong. It is hard to decide." Were it not for the fact that what is unsatisfactory in the sexual function is spelled out quite confidently in the footnote that, while typographically presented as an appendage to the text, is actually the chapter's startlingly decisive conclusion. Truly satisfactory sex, sex that can, as Freud puts it, convulse our being, was lost when, with the adoption of an erect posture, both anal eroticism and olfactory stimulation were subjected to organic repression. Since this verticalizing misfortune, I quote, the sexual function has been accompanied by a repugnance which cannot further be accounted for and which prevents its complete satisfaction, end quote. Not only that, while Freud writes, I quote again, there exist even in Europe peoples among whom the strong genital odors, which are so repellent to us, are highly prized as sexual stimulants, end quote. Many civilized people cannot tolerate the strong sensations of smell to which the genitals give rise, sensations which spoil sexual intercourse for them. It's not clear whether the always exciting sight of unbeautiful genitals evoked earlier can survive the repulsion produced by their odor. Our poor, discursively battered genitals are subjected, so to speak, to a restless movement between the eyes and the nose. What are we to make of this organ, at once visually exciting and olfactorily repellent, the source of both the most intense pleasure we know and a largely unaccountable and intractable repugnance? More profoundly, what are we to make of this ambivalence, this confusion about our sexual bodies? I suggest that we see in it something quite admirable, a confessional pressure in the form of the most concrete, specific sensations to which Freud will courageously respond, to which, if psychoanalysis is to be different from classical psychology, he must respond by seeking to know how the psyche makes sense, although a very particular kind of sense, of sensation. Or, to put this in terms I mentioned earlier, how do we coerce language into bridging the gap, into reunifying a human subject, presumably divided by the great human acquisition, language, that irrevocably divides us from our bodies? That task is, in psychoanalysis, the work of the drive. What does Freud mean by a drive? Trieb, translated inappropriately, as most of you probably know, in the standard edition of Freud's work as instinct. Freud's 1915 essay, Drives and Their Vicissitudes, begins with a somewhat troubled effort to answer that question. I'm going to give you a tedious 2 or 3 minutes to go through what I think is an interestingly troubled first paragraph. A drive is not, apparently, one of what Freud calls those clear and sharply defined basic concepts, which people wrongly assume to be the foundation of all scientific activity. Science begins, Freud writes, with a description of phenomena, which it then proceeds to group, clarify, and correlate. However, even at this early stage of scientific investigation, certain abstract ideas, this is a quote, derived from somewhere or other, but certainly not from new observations alone, are necessarily applied to the material being described, ideas which will later become the basic concepts of the science. These ideas are at first uncertain. He says there can be no question of any clear elaboration of their content. They are not deduced from the material of observation, which in fact is subject to those abstract, undefined ideas, which, Freud adds, are in the nature of conventions. If they necessarily have important relations to the empirical material from which, as we have just been told, they are not deduced, but which they actually seem to determine, we seem to sense those relations before being able to clearly recognize and demonstrate them. Freud adds, I quote, "More searching, thorough investigation of the field of observation does help us to clarify the concepts underlying the investigation. Now these concepts, into which the preliminary abstract ideas have evolved, are modified by the work of observation, which helps us to confine the concepts in definitions. Confined, yet also flexible definitions. Basic concepts erroneously thought of as the solid a priori foundation of scientific observation are, as science progresses," Freud writes, "constantly being altered in their content. A drive is a still somewhat obscure, conventional, basic concept of this kind," he writes. Although after a couple of pages of what Freud describes as a physiological approach to drives, he is compelled, as he puts it, to make a further admission. We need yet another category. We do not merely apply certain conventions to our empirical material as basic concepts. In dealing with what we are now looking at as psychological phenomena, we must also make use of what Freud calls a number of complicated postulates, the most important of which, for our present concerns, is of a biological nature. And it states that the task of the nervous system is, speaking in general terms, to master stimuli. So, basic concepts, abstractions, conventions, confined definitions, postulates, physiology, psychology, biology. The drive as drive is much more elusive than psychic phenomena such as sadism and masochism, which will be classified as specific types or vicissitudes of drives. There is a significant hesitation about whether or not the drive can even be called a concept, and if it can, about its conceptual stability. What is it that remains constant when its content is altered? Are we dealing primarily with a physiological or psychological concept? Interestingly, the work Freud engages in at this foundational level of definition exemplifies, I'll return to this in a moment, the work of the drive itself. His conceptual wandering is an anticipatory recapitulation of the mobility intrinsic to the drive. But in order to specify that mobility, Freud finds it necessary to postulate a more general truth about the relation of the mind both to the body and the world. He begins by proposing the hypothesis of the drive as a species of stimulus, a stimulus to the mind. And we should remember that not all stimuli are of instinctual origin. An example of a non-instinctual, non-drive stimuli is a strong light striking the eye. Freud then repeats an idea recurrent in his work since the 1890s, an idea that will find its most original and extreme expression in Beyond the Pleasure Principle of 1920. I quote, "The nervous system is an apparatus which has the function of getting rid of the stimuli that reach it, or of reducing them to the lowest possible level, or which, if it were feasible, would maintain itself in an altogether unstimulated condition, end quote. Unlike external stimuli that can be withdrawn from by flight or muscular movements, no actions of flight avail against the internal stimuli of drives, I quote, which oblige the nervous system to renounce its ideal intention of keeping off stimuli, for they maintain an incessant and unavoidable afflux of stimulation, end quote. But this very inability to fulfill its ideal intention has had in human evolution a positive effect. I quote again, we may therefore conclude that drives and not external stimuli are the true motive forces behind the advances that have led the nervous system with its unlimited capacities to its present high level of development, end quote. We have then developed under the stress and thanks to the pain of unavoidable stimulation. We might say that the drive itself, as Freud finally defines it, testifies to this incomparable efficiency. I quote, to the mind's ability to transform a kind of attack from within the organism into an exemplary, highly sophisticated and potent, this is no longer a quote, to transform that attack into an exemplary, highly sophisticated and potent instance of the human organism's oneness, of a profoundly anti-Cartesian unity of mind and the res extensa of body. A drive is, and here is the definition the first few pages have been leading up to, I quote, a concept on the frontier between the mental and the somatic, as the psychical representative of the stimuli originating from within the organism and reaching to the mind, as a measure of the demand made upon the mind for work in consequence of its connection with the body. Like the world, the body interpolates the mind. The latter receives what it may at first take as an attack, but to which it responds as if it were receiving, to use Proust's phrase when he talks about Vanteuil's music, as if it were receiving a strange call, one that demands work. The mind seeks a psychical representative that will both carry and contain inherently mobile and uncontainable somatic energies. The drive is not exactly a representation of a stimulus. Rather, it stands in for it, being a kind of psychic delegate of a bodily call which faithfully replicates the energy of its corporeal constituency. Drives are our psychic bodies. They are the mind's energetic reformulations of the internal stimuli constantly pressing upon it. There is no flight except death or a psychotic withdrawal from the world, from the pulsating presence of these multiple stimuli incessantly demanding to be psychically represented. Like the floating affects that remain in consciousness after the representations to which they belong have been repressed, stimuli wander in consciousness in search of the images or the behavior that will be our response to them. The body shocks the mind into accounting for its intensities, into producing psychic doubles of those intensities, therefore responding to multiple calls, a summons that it reestablish and reconfirm the oneness of body and mind. I will only say parenthetically here that we might think of this as analogous to what I have described elsewhere as the traumatic shock of art, shocks that open other relational fields that, most consequentially, might even reconfigure the social and the political. And there is no reason not to include fields of thought in this relational expansiveness. The first few pages of Drives and Their Vicissitudes can serve as an example, among countless others, of Freud's energetic, at times incoherent, openness to intellectual stimuli. In them, Freud appears to be searching for the methodological apparatus that will lead him to the definition which, in fact, they already enact and confirm. The tentative, shifting thought of these first pages performs the work that responds to, that is a measure of the demand made upon the energy of the mind by virtue of the mind's connection with the body. That work is intrinsic to the drive. It is what the drive does with internal stimuli. Furthermore, in calling the drive itself a concept, Freud makes clear that the short paragraph defining the drive is not the intellectual resolution of the methodological wandering that precedes it, but is rather itself constitutive at a higher level of intensity of the work being done by the thinking that has been moving toward it. Where in the body has this particular demand come from? It is as if the drive itself were demanding its own intellectual representative. The drive is a drive-driven concept. The body is the mind's most intimate world. Furthermore, it extends, both physically and ontologically, into the world that surrounds it, and into the universe inhabited by that world. The difficult demand made on the mind by all those worlds, the call they make to us, is not that we think about or against them, but rather that our thought be the passionately energetic delegate to jump in ending from the psychic to the cosmic, my current project, to be the passionately energetic delegate of the cosmic explosions, upheavals, movements, and settlings that, very late in their still unfinished history, at last gave birth to thought and its work. Thank you.
Starting from what you took as a point of departure, which is, after all, something you find in Hegel, that Hegel calls the joke of nature, that the organ of generation is also the organ of urination. I'm wondering whether you're not pushing Freud towards an almost Bataillon position where, thanks to the drive, there is no idealization possible. And so there is no beauty, but only the excrement, the excess, the informal, and hence something like Bataille's paradoxical politics of friendship, but no social organization that would imply some kind of idealization. I'm not sure whether this is the direction you wanted to take, but would be a possibility at least.
That's interesting. The Bataille direction, interests me very much, but I think something else is going on here, and it's not, the something else is not at all, as you suggest, an idealization, but it is, which I think is different from excess in Bataille, it is a socializing through language of the body, and I think that's very important. I mean, it's sort of, and it connects up somewhere with sublimation too, I think. But sublimation in the sense, and it's extraordinary, a lot of these things which don't come together explicitly in Freud, but they they should go together, and I think they do go together. And Laplanche, for example, has been one of the people who sees that they do, things can go together. For example, it just occurred to me while you were asking that question that the kind of socializing of the body, which keeps the bodily energy and somehow is its delegate and not its transcendence in any way, is very much what Freud says, and which has often been overlooked until Laplanche, I think. What Freud says when he discusses, in the Leonardo essay at the end, what happens to this to sexual excitement in infancy. It's repressed. But then he says there's a part that is not repressed, and what happens to that? And the extraordinary thing is that that nourishes sublimation. So the sublimation is a sexually energized phenomenon, which for a long time has been thought of as something that transcends, that is non-sexual or asexual, and not necessarily anti-sexual, but an asexual thing. But Laplanche insists a lot about the neo-sexuality of sublimation. I mean, I think that's a wonderful expression. And I think that that's connected to this work of trying to make the body, to provide for the body some kind of psychic delegation. I mean, it's very, how do you think the body? I mean, I think that this interests me very much I think that we've developed a syntax, the cause and effect syntax, what we usually think of as how you think reasonably or logically, which is sidestepping to a certain extent what I will sort of imprudently call the syntax of the body. So can we work out some kind of other type of syntax? Anyway, that would be... But that's an interesting... I mean, the Bataille thing is interesting, but I don't think it's exactly the same thing.
Thank you very much for that wonderful talk. My question is about the precise concept that you have, or the way that the drive functions as concept. Would you say that it's closer to a kind of determinate handle on a kind of sensory manifold, something like the... Is it closer to something like a determinate... a sort of a handle determinate labeling, a determinate thing under which is subsumed a kind of sensory manifold from the body, or is it more of a kind of antecedent to a whole sort of process like that?
I didn't get that. Or more of a what?
Is it antecedent to a kind of, to that kind of process? Is it something wherein sort of thought gets preceded by a kind of bodily function in general, where it's kind of two categories of cognition and sensation would be sort of deconstructed. Would have them sort of flowing into one another, more of like a Deleuzean kind of way? Is it the first one or the second one? Sorry if that was a long question.
I think it would be that, but I've sort of forgotten what the first alternative was.
Sorry. So it's not sort of a means of categorization or sort of universalization of a particular. It's not something that precedes that.
Okay, yeah. No, I don't think it's a means of... I don't think it's a means of categorizing, and I think... I mean, that's an interesting word, because, you know, the word is so important in philosophy and category, and especially in Kant. But I think that one of the interesting things about psychoanalytic thought, and you have to be more of a professional philosopher than I am to go further in this, is that it really... tries to avoid, in spite of sometimes falling into it, categorical thinking. And that's very important, I think. So that I don't think it's a category that's trying to, you know, for example, we need, although often Freud thinks in that way. I mean, when he talks, a lot of when he talks about the death drive is as if, well, finally we found the category that will explain this, you know, several phenomena. But I don't think it works as a category. And, you know, and he keeps saying, and this going back and forth between observation, as that first confused paragraph, is going back and forth between observation and concepts. You know, it's sort of, he has the concept of the death drive, for example. This is, I'm just trying to say the way, it's very difficult to answer your question because it's difficult to define exactly how the so-called conceptual works in psychoanalysis. And I'm giving this one example of the death drive, which is a concept that he comes up with, and then starts looking around for examples of it. You know, he wants to be a scientist very much, so we're looking for observation. And he says we can't find it anywhere, except when it's mixed with sex, with sexuality, with sexual pleasure. This is very strange. The death drive is somehow mixed with... But that won't stop Freud from saying it's the opposite of sexual pleasure, which he does. You know, there's on the life drive, which is sexuality, procreation. On the other side is the death drive. And he says there are two perfectly distinct things. But then it turns out the death drive is unlocatable, except when it's mixed with its presumed opposite. So, I mean, there you're beginning to... When you get to that kind of categorical impasse, then I think the whole idea of what concept means in these few pages is very problematic. And I don't feel as if I've satisfactorily defined it, but it's certainly not the way we usually think of concept in a categorical way. Does that answer partly what you
mean? Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you a little bit more, to talk a little bit more about the place of aesthetics or aesthetic thinking in the reading of Freud that you're developing. Because it strikes me that there are two moments in the argument that you've developed, specifically in the reading of The Drive, where aesthetics plays a subtly different role. And I'm wondering if the two have an important relationship to each other. The first that you mentioned was this curious aesthetic paradigm whereby the genitals can appear simultaneously beautiful, which is, you know, the sine qua non of aesthetic categorization, and then repulsive, which isn't, in classical terms, an aesthetic paradigm, but certainly speaks to a number of aesthetic paradigms. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, the moment of aesthetic apprehension, which the drive seems to nominalize, or seems to call into being in a certain sense. There's a sort of aesthetic subjectivity that emerges at the moment that one is understanding or experiencing a drive. My question, I think, is, does psychoanalysis, in your view, allow one to experience disgust and beauty simultaneously? And if so, does it speak to a longer history of an aesthetics of disgust? Because we tend to think of that aesthetics as being something that exists in the post-Freudian era, for instance. Mm-hmm.
To think of what in the post-Freudian era, just... specify that to me.
I think that, perhaps I'm wrong, but it strikes me that in the 19th century, at least, people didn't use the language of disgust when they were engaging in aesthetic discourse. Yeah. And I don't think it appears in any of Freud's attempts to discuss aesthetics directly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think we're moving slowly back to Bataille, and beauty and disgust and sort of... I've been moving away from that, so I'm at something of a bind myself about the... I think that the kind of aesthetic, if we're going to use that word, that Freud is pointing to, would certainly be, in that sense, compatible with what we ordinarily and banally call disgust. That the aesthetic is not simply locatable in that word, the beautiful. I mean, which it, in itself is a very unspecifiable word. But I'm coming to think of, and this I really will not be able to explain very far. I'm coming to think of the aesthetic as something. The way in which some people have been thinking about the aesthetic is a moment in the history of ontology rather than something that has to do specifically with art. I think the aesthetic, as I think of it, is a certain way of thinking about being, a certain way about thinking of being that has to do with And now it's not going to work very well because I'm thinking of the notion in Heidegger, for example, of shining. I think there's that notion of some kind of, and I know that this will sound vague, but a shining of being that happens in what we think of as art. And that this is a manifestation of being different from philosophical elaborations in the past into ontological questions. Now, there's a lot of work to do in thinking about that, and I'm not sure I can go too much further with that, except I think, strangely enough, that in the work that Eunice Dutoit and I have done on film, I think that we get close to something where some aesthetic phenomenon, and I think mainly of Terrence Malick's film, The Thin Red Line, which we discuss in the trouble of writing so many books as you can't remember, but it is the forms of being. Right, thanks. And I think they're in trying to analyze the mode of being that's embodied in that film in Wit, I forget the actor's name, who unfortunately played Christ in Mel Gibson's Christ, but he's wonderful in Malick's. You know what I'm saying?
Jim Caviezel.
Right. Jim Caviezel, right. That is an aesthetic representation of being. It's sort of a form of being embodied in the world, which is very different from the formal embodiment of the figure played by Sean Penn in that film. And I think there are two aesthetic groupings in two different bodies, but they represent two different modes of being with the world. So it is really an ontological aesthetic in a way. But it's all done through form. And that's what I mean by aesthetics as a moment, maybe, in the history of it.
In both those cases as well, it strikes me that there's a relationship between aesthetics as an ontology and disgust as a kind of ontology as well, in that both of these performances have some relationship with a grotesque or dismembered body.
Yes, perhaps. I haven't thought of that. But, yeah, yes, why not? I mean, it should be integrated. And I'm thinking of, since Jean-Michel raised Bataille, I can't help thinking of, I've written on this novel now, I've forgotten the title, with Dirty, what's the?
Bleu du ciel,
yeah. Where I think that, the disgust there is a function of its aesthetic. It's aesthetics. And the disgust is very explicit.
I wanted to go back to the death drive, because I was thinking this during the talk, that this account of the drive as a sort of an internal stimulus machine that you can't really get away from, in distinction from external stimuli, which you can do something about, is somehow poorly suited to Freud's account of the death drive, in that the death drive is precisely the expression, the internal psychic expression, or somatic expression, I don't know, of the entire psychic and somatic system's urge towards stasis. So that the account of the internal drive to which the psyche is going to respond in some way in order to return to stasis is undone by the death drive, which is that very urge towards the return towards stasis. You see where I'm going? There's a kind of strange sort of meta loop going on here, a feedback loop between drive and response to drive, and I'm wondering if you can sort it out for me.
I think that the direction into which we're going for defining, or maybe redefining, but it's been done, it hasn't been done before, redefining the death drive is not in the direction of a stasis, but it's in the direction of a kind of, what Laplanche called a kind of ébranlement of the self. So what I talked about a lot in the Freudian body is a self-shattering, which in a way is a kind of death. It's destructive. It sort of shatters. It's the thing that I've become fascinated by now. It's like the Big Bang in a way that it explodes in a way. So there is something connected to destruction. But it's a destruction that is intensely energetic and produces more energy in a way. It is self-destroying and self-energizing at the same time. I suppose it's as close... You know, I try to avoid this word because it's been so overused mainly by American academic critics. I think the word jouissance in French. But it is something... I think what at its best, when it's used at its best, for example, I think at certain moments in Lacan, when jouissance is used, it's really trying to get the two things together. That is intense pleasure and even evil of destructiveness. And if we can think of something like that, maybe that the death drive should be reformulated, and the move towards stasis, that has to be rethought again. I mean, I would move that into some other area of thinking. It's very important, but I don't think that's the most interesting aspect of the death drive, especially as the death drive moves towards an identification, as Laplanche explicitly said, with sexuality. So you have to think of the stasis thing separately. It's very important, though. I'm interested. It's very funny. I mean, almost everything I've done since I first began to write was sort of being interested in mobility. And then somebody pointed out to me that with all the interest in mobility, and this is very incoherent, and I have no way to account for it, with all the interest in mobility, I also have talked a lot about immobility as a kind of special state. And in fact, it's the chapter in one of my books on D.H. Lawrence, who I've been teaching recently, and who I'm going to teach again at Penn next spring, and who I think is an absolutely, absolutely extraordinary writer. But the title of my chapter, this friend pointed out, I'd forgotten, is Laurentian Stillness. And the whole chapter is about how Lawrence in Women and Love is trying to move sexuality toward a kind of ideal stasis in which we would be, as he says, and again in sort of cosmological terms, we would be, he says to Ursula, like two stars, poised, balanced with respect to it. It's a passage that can easily be made fun of, and then those who don't like Lawrence, they do make fun of it. But I think it's very interesting, because that's stasis and immobility. And I'm not quite sure how to get that together with, I mean, I'm not sure at all how to get that together with the drive and sexuality. Right. Maybe it'll come one day.
My question, hi Leo. My question,
I can't see you in the dark.
follows directly from that idea, which is, so you gave us a very lovely close reading of drives and their vicissitudes. A vicissitude is, of course, a type of movement. And yeah. Freud, in fact, lists several styles of movement that the drive can, that can transform, that can befall the drive. It can turn back, to circuit back upon the self.
Interesting, yeah.
It can go straight towards its object. It can flip into its opposite. Or it can be sublimated, which he describes as a kind of elevation.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if there's a way to put the question about movement and styles of movement together with that little taxonomy of vicissitudes that Freud offers.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes, I think it would. I think that this essay and what I've been talking about are not in... That the notion of stasis is not relevant to this essay. I think the movement is much more relevant. And what you remind me, I mean, it's true, the essay is structured very much. I've been concentrating so much on those first few pages that I've sort of almost forgotten what the rest of the essay does. But it does a lot simply in
sort of, sort of geometric ways of sort of moving up, all various kind. And this is very interesting because if a drive is engaged in that movement, it sort of suggests that the body itself has a kind of geography, not simply of anatomically locatable and immobilizable parts, but that the body in some way is always in movement. Of course, it is a great deal, but I think in trying to get a way in which the body moves in ways that we usually don't think of, and that might be consistent with drives moving forward, back, up, that's very interesting. And what would be the observational, is there one, do we even need one, of that kind of movement? I mean, where do you ever see, you know, a drive moving backward or forward? It's sort of, I mean, it's in certain aspects you do. I mean, between scaptophilia and if you sort of want to look or move back from looking, you can imagine the body doing it. But not all the times, I think, when he talks about movement. But thank you. That's very interesting.
I also have a question, if that's okay. As sort of fascinated and very much enjoyed in the first part of your talk, the references to the genitalia, which was sort of exciting, albeit malodorous, sort of very much in the forefront of what was going on. But then they sort of fell into the background. You sort of describe this paradox of smelly but exciting genitalia as a challenge to Freud and a challenge to psychoanalysis to theorize what was going on. And the segue was to a discussion of the drives. But then I felt like the genitalia was sort of left dangling there in a sort of strange way, and you never really returned to them. And I mean, I was wondering whether that's symptomatic of there being a gap between the physical and always being a gap between the physical and the work of psychoanalysis at the end of the day, or whether there's some way you could return from the drive back to this presence.
No, that's interesting. I mean, there's a very, I should be embarrassed to admit this, but there's a very simple answer to your question, which is, I'll give a better answer, which is that I wrote those two things completely separately. So that it's true, the second part really doesn't, it was written as part of a paper on that had absolutely nothing to do with that. But then someone mentioned this funny, this funny thing about Freud and the importance of sexuality in Freud, and yet the way he talks about it. So I thought, we'll put them together. But anyway, there's a better way to talk about it, I think. And I don't think that, actually, this is sort of, trying to justify myself, but I don't think that one should come back to the discussion of the beginning in the literal terms in which I was talking about it and in which Freud himself talks about it in those footnotes. That I think when he talks about the genitals, and it's comical and confused. I mean, it just is. And it's because he's trying to talk about the body in a way that's not adequate to the excitements of the body. And so he comes up with what in logical discourse is a bunch of paradoxes and contradictions about the beautiful being repulsive and so forth. And also we're wondering how we manage to get excited when we're on 2 feet. I mean, it's sort of a mystery, and it really sounds so sad, and but I think that's trying to deal with it in a language that's not useful for talking, or that's not relevant to the way in which the body interpolates the mind. In that first part of my talk, Freud is talking about the way in which some very specific things, the history of the human body, when it was on all fours, when it stood up, the relation between disgust at part of the body, the smells of the body, and sexual excitement. I mean, you're really trying to think about all that. But you can't make much conceptually out of all that, except something slightly funny and sort of messy, logically. But in the second point, when you do think about the drive, all of that thought about the bodies, the genitals, smells and undesirability and beauty and so forth are, in the French sense, recuperated or sort of brought back into having a sense when you think about the body in the terms that he tries to think about it in the essay on the drives. That it's that the drives are the closest we can get to mentalizing or psychicalizing the body. And that the talk, the literal talk about parts of the body and their excitedness or not excitedness, or excitability, whether they're exciting or not, is anecdotal conversation. And it's not. But it shows an impasse. I mean, what I said is that I think it's very interesting that psychoanalysis is after all. I mean, something that really, it occurred to me that, you know, if psychoanalysis were really called accurately, should it be psychoanalysis or soma analysis? I mean, I really think it's a philosophy. Psychoanalysis is a philosophy of the body. And that the way in those first few pages of my talk, that's not, that you may have to begin talking that way in gathering together material, but it's not the way you would talk about it philosophically, psychoanalytically. It's sort of anecdotal, that first part.
Maybe, thank you for your talk. It's very thought-provoking. And my association was first with disgust, and I was thinking of hysteria.
Of what?
Hysteria. And in hysteria, what you have is any part of the body could behave like a sexual organ. So we have an erogenous body where any body part could become like a genital or like a circulation of genitals all throughout the body. Like any hole could become like a sexual organ. Right. And I was also thinking about your, maybe the answer to this question between stasis and mobility through you're referring to jouissance as it hurts so good, the masochism of sexuality, and that maybe that's a lead in understanding at times repetition, that could be a manifestation clinical of the death drive. Why do we keep on doing the same things that hurt us and derive a pleasure that cannot be distinguished from pain, where pain and pleasure cannot be fell apart. And I was thinking what you were saying at the end, that was very inspiring, that maybe psychoanalysis is somatology or soma analysis. Yeah. And how do you think your examples of body are through texts? How do you think writing could play in how we assume a body, because we have bodies, we are not bodies, how we deal with our sexual bodies through writing, letters, texts?
Well, I don't, I mean, I think that you have to write your body. But what is that? I mean, I don't have any formula for that, except whenever I pick up a book that is very intelligent, but that I know doesn't interest me at all. It's a book that hasn't been written with the body. And when I pick up a book that may be sort of naive and even a little sloppy, but it has a rhythm or a syntax, and this is very... I'd really love to think more about this, but I haven't, obviously. There is a way in which you can recognize... I mean, I think Lawrence is someone... And I think this is why he so enrages and has enraged. I think he writes with his body. And there are those two or three pages preface to Women in Love when he addresses the question of how he's been attacked for his style. And he says, it's half a sentence. He just said, style should translate, and I'm getting it wrong, but it's something like, style should translate all of the pushing, the kind of pulsations of trying to, we still have to put it in words. I mean, it's almost like the definition of the drive. He said, you know, he's against, in Women in Love, he's against, you know, certain forms of knowledge, of talk, of wordiness, of everything that Hermione in that novel represents. At the same time, he says, the new being has to be put into words. And this is the new being of bodies, has to be somehow, sensuality has to somehow be linguistified, languagefied in some way. What kind of style is the bodily? And I think Lawrence is an example of that. But it's difficult. And I don't think, in some funny way, I don't think Proust is. And it's sort of my, I mean, those are the two novelists I've thought most about in my life, and mainly Proust. But Lawrence has made me sort of downgrade Proust a little, which is probably quite stupid of me, but at any rate. It's because I think he's always making such an effort not to think with his body, and he does a lot, which makes him great, but there's such an effort not to. But I want you just to, maybe we could end with this one thing about hysteria. That's interesting. I think the difference between the body being eroticized in hysteria is, isn't it sort of a monotonous repetition of always the genitals being...
No,
it can be any body part. No, I know, but what that body part, what the hysterical reaction is to treat any body part as if it were the genitals, no? Whereas what I think the drive is trying to do is to sort of work out a multiplicity of bodily sensations that would not be simply a repetition of the same sexual, it wouldn't be a sort of massive invasion of the body by that one type of excitement that's inappropriately attached to every, you know, from the toes to the top of the head. But rather the toe and the top of the head should have their own sexualization in a way, or eroticization. And so I'd be much more on the side of Foucault in thinking about this, you know, when he says we have to invent new pleasures of the body, mysterious and exasperating summons, since, you know, when I first read that, and I never had the nerve when he was at Berkeley to simply ask him what he could have meant by that, since I went through every kind of pleasure I could imagine. Maybe I just had a weak imagination of that. And I thought, well, I don't think there are any other ones that I've skipped. And it's sort of, but I think he was trying to move in that direction of sort of multiplicity of sort of making the body come alive again in a multiplicity of ways and not in a sort of neurotic, hysterical way.